disclaimer. The following broadcast gives a true and honest account of the events described, and all evidence and details herein are solely factual. What you are about to hear is real and may disturb you. Caution is strongly advised. Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
If you enjoy our show and find our research interesting, please consider supporting us. Head over to deathcult.com and find out how you can support our research and investigations. We truly appreciate you helping us out. You can also find us over on Instagram if that's more your thing. Just search Dead Souls Podcast and we'll come up. As always, thank you for joining us.
I know this isn't scientific, but this ship is warning me that she is going to die and take a lot of people with her. Thomas Andrews, chief designer of the RMS Titanic.
I've wanted to produce an episode on this subject for some time, but as always, I wanted to maintain a factual stance throughout. Much has been said about the Titanic and those who sailed and ultimately perished upon her, but I wanted to be sure not to romanticize the story or contribute to its mythology. In many ways, the story of Titanic has embraced and filled the public consciousness as a cautionary tale about the perils of human hubris and how mankind's creativity and innovation burned their wings whilst flying too close to the sun. This is a Dead Souls contribution to a tragic Anglo-Americana parable. This is Titanic. In 1898, Morgan Robertson authored a short novel titled Futility. It was a story about a British ocean liner named the Titan that sinks in the North Atlantic during its maiden voyage and following a collision with an iceberg. The book was popular upon release, and for those who read the book at the time, little would they realize the significance of the story until 14 years later, when a ship named the Titanic would claim over 1,500 souls with her when she would sink in the North Atlantic and become one of the most devastating and talked about naval disasters in history. Still very much is studied and remembered to this day, the story of the Titanic resonates in emotions and legend, even now over 100 years later. We are going to take a look at the events leading up to the disaster, the people involved and their moving and incredible stories, alongside some of the most common theories that have since been published, pointing to the failings in the ship's design and the greed of those involved, leading many to believe the sinking of the RMS Titanic was an entirely preventable disaster and need not ever have happened. The White Star Line was originally founded in Liverpool, United Kingdom in 1845 as a packet trading company, which operated a United Kingdom to Australia shipping route during the Great Australian Gold Rush. As the gold began to fade, the company, which was then facing bankruptcy, was taken over by Thomas Henry Ismay in 1868. Under Ismay, the company began to commission new ocean liner ships from Belfast shipbuilders Harland and Wolff. In just 2 years by 1870, they launched the first breakthrough ship, the Oceanic One. It was the first in a series of state-of-the-art superliners the company built that dominated the Australian business and eventually transatlantic routes. By 1899, Thomas Ismay had died, and he left the way clear for his son, Joseph Bruce Ismay, to impress his vision upon the White Star Company. He introduced a concept of comfort, affluence, experience and privilege over speed and economy, a policy the White Star Line would become famous for. Though extremely successful, just a few years later in 1902, the company was acquired by the International Mercantile Marine Company, which was headed by Joseph Pierpont Morgan, and soon after, Joseph Bruce Ismay was appointed the overall president of the company. By 1907, rival company Cunard was having unrivaled success with their two quadruple-funneled super-fast liners, Lusitania and Mauritania. So in an effort to remain competitive, Ismay proposed the construction of three Olympic-class liners with opulent interiors. Even though they couldn't rival Cunard for speed, this was irrelevant to Ismay, as they would make up for it in grandeur and never-before-seen luxury. The ships would be called the Olympic, Titanic, and Britannic. All three ships would be equipped with the newest tech in turn-of-the-century design and innovation, which would include 16 watertight compartments in their lower sections that could easily be sealed off in the event of a punctured hull, and which would make the liners, the company proudly announced, unsinkable. The first of the superliners launched is Olympic, and she officially becomes the world's largest man-made moving object, quite simply a palace on the sea. However, this title was short-lived, because on May the 31st, 1911, the RMS Titanic is launched in Belfast, in front of a crowd of over 100,000 people. Opulence had a new name. Luxury and splendor now sailed the ocean waves, and what's more, the White Star Line boasted, not even God himself could sink this ship. The Titanic's interior was fitted out with lavish rooms, expertly created by highly skilled craftsmen, producing cabins and luxury quarters fit for some of the richest and most powerful people in the world. In addition, Titanic was equipped with 20 lifeboats, more than the required number requested by the Board of Trade regulations and legal requirements. They were well within the law, and White Star Line jokingly stated that as the ship couldn't sink, they were purely regulatory and unnecessary. Whilst legal, nobody at the time, unfortunately, took the time to research or take into consideration that Titanic was 46,000 tons, with a capacity for 3,327 people on board. 20 lifeboats, packed to capacity, would still only be enough for 52% of the passengers. Or, maybe they did do the math and realize that 52% of the passengers would cover all first and second class passengers, with the addition of all crew. Just not any third-class passengers. Who knows, society and culture certainly was a different breed back then. Although I will add that its lifeboats were considered as ferries that would take multiple trips to and from a sinking ship to a rescue vessel, and not as a sole means of escaping. Then, so long as said ship is in close proximity to the sinking vessel, the number of lifeboats would have been sufficient. Mind you, so would one single rubber dinghy if you had the time, so this argument is fairly laughable in my opinion. I digress. A date for Titanic's modern voyage to New York was announced for the 20th of March 1912. However, after Olympic is damaged during her maiden trip, Titanic is given a revised sail date of the 10th of April 1912. You have to wonder if the Olympic had not had a collision which altered Titanic's sail date. Then what would the fate of the Titanic have actually been? On April the 3rd, 1912, Titanic arrives in Southampton from Belfast in preparation for her much-anticipated maiden voyage. The ship receives her signal flags and pennants, and the final crew members are recruited. She is loaded up with cargo and coal, and on the 8th of April, fresh food and supplies are stored in preparation for the many mouths she is to feed during their 7-day trip. So finally, the day arrives to set sail. The captain, Edward John Smith, is a much respected and well-liked employee of the White Star Line. At 62 years old, he was coming to the end of his career at sea, but his knowledge, track record and experience made crew and passengers alike confident that they had the best man White Star Line had to offer at the helm. It was reported, although also disputed, amongst other sources, the Titanic was to be Captain Smith's last voyage before retirement. What wasn't as common knowledge at the time was that despite Smith's experience, he had also encountered many mishaps while in command, especially with the introduction of much larger vessels than he was previously used to commanding. White Star, however, considered him the right man to take charge of the world's greatest ship, and he was given a handsome salary of around $6,250 per year, or around $195,000 annually today, plus a yearly bonus of $1,000, or $30,000 today, if he returned his ships undamaged. So no small amount. Smith would be accompanied by Chief Officer Henry Wilde and First Officer William Murdoch, along with a total of 885 other crew members. With the crew now in place, the Titanic passengers can now begin the pleasure of boarding. Those who boarded included 325 first-class passengers, where absolutely no expense was spared in their cabins, two of which were called the Millionaire Suites, and were considered to be the most luxurious accommodation of the day. One of the suites was booked for J.P. Morgan, but he chose not to travel, so it was taken up by Joseph Bruce Ismay. As a first-class guest, he and the others could enjoy the opulent Jacobean and Regency-style dining room, a sumptuous reception room which could be entered using one of Titanic's most prized features, the magnificent Grand Staircase. Gentlemen had the option of returning to the smoking room for port and cigars, and, in the day, they could relax in the Veranda Café or Café Parisien, or make use of the fully equipped state-of-the-art gymnasium or heated swimming pool. As for the 285 second-class passengers, they too enjoyed a luxury that rivaled first-class on any other liner of the day, and they were first to enjoy electric elevators. In comparison, the 706 third-class, or steerage passengers, did not enjoy such luxuries, although they did have more comfort than you may think. Most of the third-class passengers had a one-way ticket. They were travelling in search of a better life in America, and they would have had all of their worldly belongings in just a few bags with them. These passengers consisted of a diverse group of nationalities ranging from Finland to Hong Kong, although the bulk of them were British, Irish, and Scandinavian. Some were travelling alone, while others with their entire families. Meals were basic but regular, although nothing in comparison to that enjoyed by first and second class. But it wasn't considered bad at all. They had a smoking and general room where they would meet and make their own entertainment, with the children playing and dancing on their deck. A little known fact about third class is that they enjoyed automatically flushing toilets, a significant luxury for third class passengers. The automation was thought to be a requirement by designers, however, rather than a luxury, as third class passengers would not be familiar with indoor plumbing at the time and would not understand the need to flush the toilets themselves. Before boarding, third-class passengers were checked for lice and other infectious diseases, then allowed to join the ship. Just before noon on the 10th of April 1912, Titanic's triple-valve whistles could be heard across Southampton. The ropes were cast and five tugboats began to slowly nudge the massive liner out into deeper water. Once she was out in the River Test and the Southampton Water estuary, just north of the Solent, the tugs dropped their lines and Titanic's triple-expansion 30,000 horsepower engines started to turn the turbines and propellers. Titanic's maiden voyage had begun, and she had at this point already made history. As she powered down the river, the turbulence she created was causing some alarm, as the large volume of water displaced by Titanic caused two moored liners to cut adrift, and their collision was narrowly avoided when Captain Smith ordered full astern and a tug intervened to prevent an early disaster. The Titanic had her first port of call in Cherbourg, France, 4 hours after leaving Southampton, where a further 274 passengers boarded from White Star tender boats SS Traffic and SS Nomadic. Tender boats were used at Cherbourg due to Titanic being too large to fit into the port. New passengers aboard included Titanic's richest passenger, John Jacob Astor IV, and his wife, with an equivalent modern-day net worth of $2.1 billion. As the Titanic turned out, the final port of call was Queenstown, now known as Cove in the Republic of Ireland. She arrived in Queenstown early at 11:30 a.m. on the 11th of April, and it was here that one lucky crew member decided to disembark by hiding in the mailbox. Later named as John Coffey, one of Titanic's firemen, he had only signed up to the crew to get a free lift to Queenstown, as he put it. Leaving Ireland at 1:30 p.m, Titanic headed out into the open waters of the Atlantic Ocean. The next stop was New York City. The crew settled into their routines and roles, and the passengers began to explore and familiarize themselves with the maze of corridors and rooms on the beautiful ship. In particular, the first-class passengers enjoyed meeting up with their wealthy and famous friends and attending the lavish parties organized for them in the splendor of their extravagant surroundings, all while Titanic moved steadily westward towards New York. All the while below deck in third class, the passengers threw their own parties, with gin and beer in the general room allocated for their entertainment. Parties celebrating the new incoming lives in America. Throughout this part of the journey, the crew continuously received warnings from other vessels communicating that there was a serious threat of icebergs along the shipping route. Despite Titanic being the most sophisticated liner of its era, its radio room by comparison was no bigger than a broom cupboard, relying entirely on Morse code for communication. Its two operators, John George Phillips and his junior, Harold Cindy Bride, worked a shift system to ensure the radio was manned at all times. From the time Titanic left Queenstown, the majority of messages travelling through the radio room were from and for the ship's passengers. In total, between 11th and 14th of April, the pair received 21 ice warnings that would be passed on to officers and ultimately Captain Smith. The crew were fully aware of the dangers that lie ahead, and even steered 20 miles off course to try and avoid the ice fields. But ultimately, this was not enough. A certain amount of arrogance and dismissal was also emitted from the crew in regards to safety, particularly regarding ice along their journey, primarily due to the ship's unsinkable reputation. On Sunday the 14th of April, another iceberg warning is received early at 9 a.m. from the RMS Caronia. Meanwhile, at this time, passengers were attending divine services in the first class dining room. The morning service was also attended by Captain Smith. At 1:42 p.m., Smith was handed an ice warning message communicated from fellow White Star liner, the Baltic. Smith handed the ice warning to Joseph Ismay, who placed the message in his pocket. Ismay allegedly showed the warning to several passengers before Captain Smith asked for it back around 7:15 p.m. that evening, and he then posted it in the chart room before dining in the a la carte restaurant. The assumption being that through pride and indifference, Ismay used the ice warning to boast to passengers at how insignificant ice was to the grand Titanic. After dining, Captain Smith returned to the bridge and chats briefly with the second officer, Charles Lightoller. Smith then retired to his cabin, given instructions to wake him if anything becomes at all doubtful. Officer Lightoller advises lookouts in the crow's nest to look specifically for icebergs. At 9:40 p.m., a message is received from the SS Mesaba, once again warning of heavy ice pack, large icebergs, and field ice in the route ahead. At 10 p.m., 2nd Officer Lightoller is replaced on duty by 1st Officer William Murdoch. At around the same time, just 55 miles north of the Titanic, the British Leyland Line steamship SS Californian has stopped for the night after spotting three icebergs and thick ice beds ahead of her. As her captain, Stanley Lord, made his way back to his cabin, he spotted a light on the horizon. He asked his third officer if there were any ships in the vicinity, to which his third officer replied, "Only Titanic, sir." Captain Lord replied, "That's not the Titanic. She's far too close in size to us." Despite this, Lord asked for the Titanic to be contacted to let her know they were stationary due to ice. Third Officer Evans duly dispatches a message and reportedly receives a curt reply from Titanic's operator, Jack Phillips. Phillips stated, "Shut up, I'm busy. I'm working Cape Race." Evans listened for a while longer, and at 35 minutes past 11, he turned off the wireless system. Meanwhile, at the same time, various reports are received on Titanic of an unusually calm ocean. This is now known to be a sign of an ice pack which is causing a mirage and making lookout duties almost impossible. Just 10 minutes later, Titanic realizes they're on a collision course with a giant iceberg. Lookouts immediately sound the warning bell and telephone the bridge with the message, "Iceberg, right ahead." Officer Murdoch orders hard a starboard to the helmsman and calls to the engine room to stop all engines. Murdoch also activates the watertight doors below that were subdividers in the hull in order to seal off any of the given 16 compartments. Murdoch expected impact. It had been calculated that the Titanic could stay afloat with 4 of these 16 compartments fully flooded. Titanic slowly veers to port, and for a few tantalizing, anxious seconds, it looks like Titanic has averted disaster. but it's too little, too late. And just moments later, the starboard side makes contact with the iceberg, damaging nearly 300 foot of the right side of the hull, both below and above the waterline. The iceberg dashes multiple slashes in the ship's metal hull, and chunks of ice shatter down onto the first and second class decks. Passengers pick up chunks of the ice and use it in their cocktails and drinks, and also throw snowballs at each other, not realizing what is happening below their feet. The Titanic is supermassive. The iceberg is even bigger, looming over the side of the ship, throwing a menacing white-blue glow across the boat. A grinding sound could be heard throughout the ship, mainly on the lower levels close to the impact zone, which causes alarm to the passengers on board. The sound of metal being chewed or crunched echoes. Some passengers begin to ask questions, but were told everything was under control. The ship briefly and gently shudders, vibrates as if a small earthquake. Only some passengers state that they felt this, others felt and heard nothing. Down in the four-peak tank, the three forward holds in boiler room number 5 and 6 were taken in heavy, icy water, and taken it in fast. Despite the workers' confused and frantic efforts to prevent any further water breach, boiler room number 5 was the only area where they were able to keep somewhat under control. Less than 10 minutes after impact, the water had risen 14 feet above the keel, and almost 4 million litres of seawater had entered the ship. Titanic was struggling. By midnight, the mailroom was flooded and mailbags could be seen floating to the surface. As water rushes into the starboard side, the ship begins to tilt downwards, listing slightly to the right, and water begins to spill over into the other watertight compartments. Captain Smith is summoned to the bridge immediately. He is joined by Titanic's architect, Thomas Andrews, and the pair go below the deck to assess the damage. It is at this point that Andrews reveals to Captain Smith that Titanic will sink. Andrews estimates Titanic would only stay afloat for a maximum of 1.5 hours, and all must abandon her immediately. Orders are given to uncover the lifeboats and prepare the crew and passengers. It's at this point that Captain Smith must have realized that even if full to capacity, the lifeboats would only hold 1,178 of the 2,227 passengers and crew who were on board. Smith knew there will be tremendous loss of life, and a humanitarian disaster lay ahead. Titanic's frantic distress calls are heard by several ships in the vicinity, but they are all too far away, with the closest being SS California, who sadly had their radio switched off. But the Carpathia was around 58 miles away, and immediately changes course and heads full steam ahead towards Titanic. At around 12:25 a.m., the first lifeboat, lifeboat number 7, is loaded with just 28 men, women and children aboard, less than half its capacity of 65, and while Captain Smith had ordered specifically only women and children to evacuate the ship at this point. All 28 passengers were first-class passengers. The lifeboats continue to be lowered with less occupancy than they are capable of holding. Initially, there was still the air that this was simply a precaution and that all would be resolved soon. Even with the reality of the ship taken in water and the Titanic's list in the water becoming more than apparent, many still did not believe that it was possible for Titanic to sink. Wallace Hartley and 7 of his musician colleagues set up their instruments on the first class deck and began to play in an attempt to keep the passengers calm during this time. They were noted to play until the very end, with their final song being heard from the lifeboats as being "Nearer, My God, to Thee." During the loading of the lifeboats, Joseph Ismay starts to interfere with the process, trying to get as many people off the ship as he possibly could, and he is abruptly commanded to halt all interference by 5th Commander Harold Godfrey Law. Multiple eyewitnesses state that Ismay was having a visible mental breakdown, distraught that so many people would die on his vessel. By 1:15 a.m, water had reached Titanic's name badge on the bow, and she is noticeably listing heavily. Confusion has now turned into panic as reality hits home when the passengers realizing the unsinkable ship is indeed going down. At 1:30 a.m, warning gunshots are fired by Officer Godfrey Law as passengers try to surge towards lifeboats. he commands the masses to get back and conduct themselves appropriately. Titanic's radio signals by now are desperate. We are sinking fast and can't last much longer. As the last of the lifeboats are lowered, Joseph Ismay jumps in, saving himself, an action that he will be criticized for and highly scrutinized for the remainder of his life. At 2:05 a.m. there were still over 1,600 people on board Titanic and just one available lifeboat left, which was lowered with 44 men, women and children inside. Titanic's forecastle head sinks beneath the waterline and her remaining passengers are left completely stranded, 400 miles from shore. At 2:10 a.m. Captain Smith goes into the radio room to relieve the operators of their duties. Titanic's last message is sent by John Phillips before Smith declares, "Well, boys, you've done your duty and you've done it well. I ask no more of you. I release you. You know the rule of the sea. It's every man for himself now, and God bless you." Following this, Captain Smith returns to the bridge to await his fate. At a time in history where it was still customary for the captain to go down with his ship. Survivor and first-class passenger Robert Williams Daniel was an eyewitness to the final moments of Captain Smith. He said, "I saw Captain Smith on the bridge, my eyes seemingly clung to him. The deck from which I had leapt was immersed, the water had risen slowly and was now to the floor of the bridge. Then it was to Captain Smith's waist. I saw him no more, he died a hero." This eyewitness report was corroborated by a number of other eyewitnesses who saw Smith's final moments. Thomas Andrews, the architect who relentlessly helped alert people to go to the deck and how to fill the lifeboats, is last seen in the first-class smoking room staring at a painting, The Plymouth Harbour by Norman Wilkinson. It showed the entrance to Plymouth Sound where Titanic was scheduled to stop on a return journey to the United Kingdom. It truly is hard to imagine what was running through his mind at this juncture, resigned to his fate, calmly awaiting the inevitable. Meanwhile, Benjamin Guggenheim, one of the Titanic's most affluent passengers, and his valet, Victor Julio, would both be remembered as true gentlemen. They knew there were not enough lifeboats for them to survive. Guggenheim had helped and comforted his female companions into lifeboat number 9 before he and Julio returned to their stateroom to take off their life vests and change into evening wear, which included a rose buttonhole. The two were then seen closing the door behind them, where they were last seen drinking brandy and smoking cigars as the Titanic was by now at the point of no return. They had done all they could for those around them and had dressed in their best finery, prepared to go down as gentlemen, as were the paraphrased words last heard from Benjamin Guggenheim himself. Father Thomas Roussel Davids Biles listens to last confessions of over 100 first and second class passengers and comforts them with absolution for their sins. He leads a group in prayer, holding the hands of his flock as the ice-cold ocean water rushes up around them. Wallace Hartley and his band finally stop playing, and by this time many of the remaining passengers have no choice other than to jump into the freezing sea, where survival time was no more than 5 to 10 minutes. Eugene Daly was a third-class passenger on board the Titanic until the very end. Just prior to the ship breaking in two, he saw the last of the lifeboats being filled. They were getting women into the boats. He stated, "There was a terrible crowd standing about. The officer in charge pointed a revolver and waved his hand and said that if any man tried to get in the boats, he would shoot him on the spot. Two men tried to break through and he shot them both. I saw him shoot them. I saw them lying thereafter. They were shot. One seemed to be dead. The other was trying to pull himself up at the side of the deck, but he could not. Afterwards, there was another gunshot, and I saw the officer himself laying on the deck. He had killed himself in shame." Titanic's forward funnel creaks loudly, and its stability lines break, whipping violently across the deck. The funnel veers and crashes down with a boom and huge plume of water as it smashed into scrambling passengers. At 2:18 a.m, a huge roar is heard as Titanic's mangled metal and interior falls towards the bow. The lights aboard start to flicker before finally being extinguished, leaving the people in the water in almost complete darkness. With Titanic's stern now dramatically in the air at a 25-degree angle, the passengers can hear the roaring, screeching, and dull boom of metal breaking and buckling under enormous stress. Under the pressure, the hull suddenly splits, causing the bow section and anyone still within here to plummet the 2 miles to the ocean floor. The stern crashes back down into the water with a roar, throwing many passengers over the side and into the icy water. The Titanic's stern continues to float for a few minutes in complete silence, but as it gets flooded with water, it begins to rise higher and higher until vertical, looming high above the water in the night sky. After only a few moments standing in suspension, the ship's stern quickly falls vertically before finally disappearing under the water and taking a less than 5 minute drop to the ocean floor and its final resting place. At the waterline, hundreds of passengers who were left in the water frantically scream and shout for help as they tread water and attempt to swim towards the lifeboats. Slowly, the noise of their screams are silenced one by one as they either drown or succumb to the freezing temperatures of the water. Those in the lifeboats can only look on in horror and take with them a sound that many will say will stay with them for the rest of their lives. At 4:10 a.m., the first of the Titanic lifeboat survivors are picked up by the Carpathia. At 8:30 a.m., the last lifeboat is picked up. By now, the California is also on the scene, searching in vain for survivors. Carpathia leaves the area and heads for New York with 705 survivors on board, leaving well over 1,500 passengers and crew unaccounted for. Joseph Ismay sends a message to the White Star offices in New York from Carpathia. It says simply, "I deeply regret to advise you. Titanic sank this morning after collision with iceberg, resulting in serious loss of life. Full particulars later." White Star Line immediately sends the cable ship CS Mackie Bennett to try and recover as many bodies as possible. She was followed by 3 other Canadian ships, each carrying embalming supplies, undertakers, and clergy. They recover 328 bodies. In mid-May 1912, over a month after Titanic sinking, RMS Oceanic recovers a further 3 bodies floating in a lifeboat, over 200 miles away from the site of the sinking. All 3 bodies were buried at sea. These 3 bodies were in a collapsible lifeboat A, and reportedly had died from starvation. It was apparent they tried eating the cork and material from their life jackets in order to survive. The body of band leader Wallace Hartley was recovered fully dressed and with his music case strapped to his body from the sea 2 weeks after the disaster by CS Mackie Bennett. Hartley's body was sent home to his father Albion, who met it at Liverpool. Hartley was buried in his hometown of Cole in Lancashire, with more than 40,000 people lining the streets to pay their respects to the hero of the Titanic. The last Titanic body recovered was Stuart James McGrady, found by a sailing boat on the 22nd of May, 1912. Many bodies sank with the ship, or currents quickly dispersed bodies and wreckage across hundreds of miles, making them difficult to recover. In all, only 333 bodies were recovered of the 1,517 that perished when Titanic sank. By June, one of the large search ships reported that life jackets supporting the passengers' bodies were coming apart and releasing bodies to sink. The majority of the recovered bodies were buried in 3 Halifax cemeteries: Fairview Lawn, Mount Olivet, and Baron de Hirsch. Those that were neither claimed nor identified were buried with a number to mark their graves. In the aftermath of the sinking and the subsequent investigation, it was agreed by 2 separate United States government and United Kingdom government investigations that an iceberg caused the disaster and the sinking was not the result of any weakness in the ship itself. It was initially believed the ship had gone down whole and was resting at the bottom of the sea in one piece. It was also initially concluded that Captain Smith was to blame for the incident, as the ship was travelling at excessive speeds through a known ice field. For many years, these remained official explanations. It wasn't until 1985 when oceanographer Robert Ballard and Jean-Louis Michel finally located Titanic's ruin 2.5 miles down, resting on the ocean floor. She was over 13 miles away from the position transmitted by Titanic's crew while the ship was sinking. After searching the area using robotic technology, the pair were able to provide the first ever detailed photographic evidence of the wreck's condition and discovered that the ship had in fact broken into two before the sinking, confirming what eyewitnesses to the event had been saying since the disaster. This led to speculation that the steel used to build the ship itself was inferior. Subsequent tests on parts of the wreck have proved this was not the case, however. It was also suggested that the 3 million rivets that held Titanic together were not strong enough. Again, this has been entirely dismissed. In recent years, conspiracy theorists have speculated that Titanic sank due to an out-of-control fire on board that had weakened her hull. A black blemish was identified by many on Titanic's right side before leaving for a maiden voyage. The blemish is visible in some photographs of the ship from the time. Recreations, material tests and scenario testing has since confirmed that this fire being blamed for speeding up her sinking is simply not true. In fact, to the contrary, scientific testing has confirmed that the fire is in fact the reason that Titanic did not roll over after taking in seawater. Due to the fire occurring before she set sail, coals were removed from the bunkers and relocated to the port side, which offset Titanic's weight and caused it to have a 3-degree list. This was on the right side, so when Titanic struck the iceberg on the left and began taking in water on the left, this 3-degree list was thus counterbalanced. It's been proven without the removal of the coal due to the fire on the right side that Titanic would have rolled left around an hour after striking the iceberg. The site where Titanic lies has become a World Heritage Site and graveyard beneath the ocean. Down there, where there is no light or sound, is the final resting place of almost 1,200 souls. People often ask, how come when scientific expeditions and submarine voyages to the wreck site never seem to find the bodies of those that perished in the disaster? The simple answer is that at that depth, and in those types of waters, a human body, bones and all, would decompose to literally nothing in less than 12 months. But what scientists have found, in the hundreds, are pairs of shoes laying side by side in the wreckage, indicating the last resting place of their owners. Laying at the bottom of the North Atlantic Ocean, amongst the most grand and most luxurious ship to have ever sailed, the RMS Titanic.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. Visit deathcult.com for more information on how you can help us and support our broadcasts. There you can also find links to our socials, Patreon, and episodes. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.